exchange of people, their animals, foodstuffs and materials facilitated the spread of microbes. By medieval times, most of the acute infectious diseases were universal in the Old World and had settled into distinct cycles of epidemics, mainly affecting young children. Many had already co-evolved with humans to become less virulent, but plague and smallpox remained fearsome killers over several centuries, standing out as the most lethal of the times. Throughout history, each has probably killed more people than all the other infectious diseases added together, between them holding the human population in check for several centuries. Bubonic Plague. The world has seen three pandemics of bubonic plague in the past 2,000 years. The first was the Justinian Plague in 1542, see Chapter 3. The second, the Black Death, and the third, which began in China in the 1860s, is still ongoing today. The legendary Black Death was only so-called hundreds of years after the event, and now no one knows why. Some say the name refers to the gangrene that sets in, turning victims' fingers and toes black just before death. But others are sure that it derives from a mistranslation of the Latin, atra mors, since atra can mean either terrible or black. The Black Death raged between 1346 and 1353, eventually spreading through the whole of Europe, Asia and North Africa. The disease hit almost every city, town, village and hamlet, wiping out nearly half the inhabitants and causing the most dramatic fall in population ever recorded. The pandemic spread to Europe from the east and can be traced to the Golden Horde, the eastern section of the Mongol Empire located in present-day Russia, where a ferocious epidemic was raging, reaching the port of Kaffa on the Black Sea in 1347. At the time, this major Genoese trading center was under siege by the Mongols, but when the epidemic broke out among their troops, they were forced to withdraw. Some say their parting shot was to catapult their dead into the city, but whatever the truth of it, the epidemic soon spread to the besieged inhabitants of Kaffa. Many Italian residents hastily set sail for home, and 12 of their galleys made for Messina on the east coast of Sicily. No sooner had they put into port than plague broke out, a disease as horrifying as it was devastating. In the words of Michael of Piazza, a Franciscan friar who wrote a first-hand account, "The burn blisters appeared, and boils developed in different parts of the body, in the sexual organs, in others on the thighs or on the arm, and in others on the neck. At first these were of the size of a hazelnut, and the patient was seized by violent shivering fits, which soon rendered him so weak that he could no longer stand upright, but was forced to lie on his bed, consumed by a violent fever and overcome by great tribulation. Soon the boils grew to the size of a walnut, then to that of a hen's egg or a goose's egg, and they were exceedingly painful and irritated the body, causing it to vomit blood by vitiating the juices. The blood rose from the affected lungs to the throat, producing a putrefying and ultimately decomposing effect on the whole body. The sickness lasted 3 days, and on the fourth at the latest, the patient succumbed. Nothing like it had ever been seen in Sicily before, and as the corpses piled up, the terrified inhabitants of Messina panicked and fled. The ship's crews were blamed for the disaster and expelled from the island. They, apparently still unaffected, joined other galleys from Kaffa sailing to Genoa and Venice, carrying the deadly microbe with them. From these Italian cities the microbe was ferried to most Mediterranean ports, and then taken inland along well-trodden trading routes, or carried, often unwittingly, as in Messina, by people fleeing from plague towns and cities. The pandemic engulfed Europe like a tidal wave, reaching France, Spain, and the Mediterranean islands in 1347 to 1348, and covering the whole continent in just 3 years. Virtually every town, village, and hamlet was caught in its deadly grasp, and in each the plague raged for around 8 months, only remitting when almost everyone had been infected and was either dead or recovered. The microbe reached British shores in the summer of 1348, probably sneaking in from France through the port of Malcolm Regis on the south coast, now part of Weymouth. The pandemic hit London later that year, killing about 20,000 to 30,000 of its 60,000 to 70,000 inhabitants. Then, travelling northwards at a rate of 1 to 1.5 kilometres per day, it covered the length of England, 500 kilometres, in around 500 days. At the time of the Black Death, the microbe had not visited Europe for 1,000 years, and so it struck indiscriminately and ferociously, killing old and young in town and country. People seemed in no doubt that the plague spread directly from one person to another, and they naturally took precautions to prevent it. Quarantine, from the Italian quaranta giorni, meaning 40 days, was first introduced in Italy and later became widely practiced throughout Europe. Plague-stricken towns were sealed off, and ships arriving from affected ports were isolated for 40 days, to prevent any person or merchandise coming ashore until all danger of infection was past. Homes of victims were marked with a red cross, and the inhabitants either isolated or removed to pest houses, hospitals appropriately described as simply waiting rooms for death. Of course, the rich could escape the infection, as royal courts often did, by moving to the country for the duration of the plague in the city, and in contrast to smallpox, which devastated European royal families, this precaution seemed to have some effect against the plague, since only one European monarch died of it. This was King Alfonso XI of Spain, who was involved in a battle with the Arabs in Gibraltar when the plague struck and refused to leave his troops. On the other hand, Pope Clement VI survived by isolating himself from the outside world and, on the advice of his doctor, sitting alone in his study between two huge open fires while the epidemic raged in Avignon. Although the plague in Europe finally abated in 1353, it resurfaced unpredictably for the next 300 years, causing terrifying epidemics that were often centred on towns while sparing the surrounding countryside, but still with the same high death toll among its victims. France and Italy, having the densest populations, were worst hit with the disease, raging almost continuously in one area or another. Britain was less affected by these ravages, since the microbe could not be sustained in its sparse island population, and each epidemic had to be introduced from the continent. The Renaissance Plague, also known as the Great Plague of London, in 1665 to 1666, was the microbe's final outburst, after which it disappeared completely from northern Europe. The famous diarist Samuel Pepys remained in London throughout the Great Plague, watching as the death toll rose alarmingly through the summer of 1665. In August, he wrote in his diary, "In the city died this week 7,496, and of them 6,102 of the plague. But it is feared that the true number of the dead this week is near 10,000, partly from the poor, who cannot be taken notice of, through the greatness of the number, and partly from the Quakers and others that will not have any bells rung for them." The capital city was still no bigger than it had been at the time of the Black Death 300 years before, but its population had increased tenfold, so it was now even dirtier and more crowded. As the microbe spread relentlessly, the rich left for healthier surroundings, abandoning the poor to their fate. Some survived the plague, only to die of starvation. For a while, anarchy reigned. Many took on the tasks of nursing the sick and guarding quarantined houses with the express purpose of bribing, robbing, or even murdering their helpless plague-stricken victims. The dead were thrown into the street, where they lay until collected by the death cart to be flung into hastily dug burial pits. Quackery abounded, but of course there were many doctors, apothecaries, and nurses who did what they could until all too often they succumbed to the microbe. Not surprisingly, despite protecting themselves with leather costumes, spice-containing beaked masks, and wands of incense, surgeons, responsible for bloodletting and knifing buboes, had the highest death rate. As often happened with the plague, the epidemic seemed to abate during the winter, but it reappeared again in the spring of 1666, just as the rich thought it safe to return to the city. And although the worst was over, another 2,000 died in London before the epidemic finally fizzled out towards the end of 1666. The official death toll was 68,595, giving a death rate of 15%, but as the rich had left, and, as Pepys pointed out, many deaths went unreported, the true number was probably significantly higher. Of course, the people of medieval Europe had no inkling that a tiny microbe might be responsible for their terrible suffering, and they variously blamed the rare conjunction of the planets, miasmic vapours, or the wrath of God. The true cause of the plague was only uncovered at the beginning of the 20th century, after an epidemic hit Hong Kong, starting the third pandemic. Plague that had been smouldering unnoticed by the outside world in the Yunnan province of China since the middle of the 19th century reached Canton in 1894, wiping out 40% of its 100,000 inhabitants. But it was only when the microbe invaded the British port of Hong Kong and threatened commercial interests worldwide that things began to happen. This was the golden age of bacteriology, when Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch were busy identifying microbes and propounding the germ theory of infectious disease. See Chapter 8. So when the cry for help came, two experienced bacteriologists took up the challenge. Alexander Yersin was a shy young Swiss microbiologist who had trained under Pasteur in Paris and travelled widely in the Far East, while Shibazaburo Kitasato was an imperious Japanese professor already famous for his groundbreaking work on tuberculosis and tetanus with Koch in Berlin. By the time Yersin arrived in Hong Kong in June 1894, Kitasato was already installed in his own laboratory, with five assistants working for him. He claimed to have found the plague bacillus in the blood of victims and was preparing to publish his findings in the medical journal, The Lancet. But Yersin, who was given no help and had to build himself a straw hut to house his laboratory, could find no bacteria in the blood of plague cases. He was keen to search for the culprit microbe in buboes, but he was denied access to the bodies of plague victims, which were all reserved for Kitasato. Rivalry between the two was intense, and in the end Yersin had to bribe mortuary attendants for access to the material he needed. But once he had it, he turned up trumps. He discovered the microbe now called Yersinia, Y. pestis, in his honour, and published his findings shortly after Kitasato. This sparked off a controversy that continued for decades. Most initially believed that the eminent bacteriologist Kitasato had to be right, and only slowly came to realize that his work was flawed. Yersin had found the true plague bacterium, but sadly the bacterium was not named after him until 1970, long after his death. At the time of the Hong Kong epidemic, most doctors, including Kitasato, thought that the plague microbe hid in soil, jumping directly from this reservoir to infected humans. Only Yersin heeded reports of dead rats littering plague-infested cities and took the trouble to investigate. He suggested that rats were the main vehicle of the infection, but it was left to his successor from Pasteur's laboratory, the equally reclusive Paul Louis Simon, to figure out the microbe's life cycle, including its reliance on rat fleas to carry it to humans, when working in India 3 years later. While the controversy over the identity of the plague microbe raged, the microbe itself silently boarded ship in Hong Kong for destinations in India, the Middle East, Africa, Europe, Russia, Japan, Australia, the Americas, Indonesia, and Madagascar. In most places, the outbreaks it spawned were soon under control, but the microbe gained a foothold in the US, which has never been eliminated, and in India it caused a devastating epidemic, killing more than 10 million people. In 1905, the Indian Plague Research Commission was set up to unravel the epidemiology of Y. pestis and devise means to stop its rampant spread. This body repeated Simon's work, confirming that the microbe primarily infects rodents but uses rat fleas to ferry itself to humans. With that, rat extermination became the mainstay of plague control in infested cities, and remained so until the advent of antibiotics converted this fearsome killer into a treatable disease. Y. pestis naturally infects burrowing rodents such as gerbils, marmots, and ground squirrels, and is spread among them by their blood-sucking fleas. Rodents show varying degrees of susceptibility to the microbe, and in colonies of resistant animals it can circulate continuously without causing any ill effect. There are several such colonies, called plague foci, in the world today, which act as reservoirs of the microbe. Most of these, including the foci in California, South Africa, and Argentina, were only established during the third pandemic, when microbes from Hong Kong found new hosts among local burrowing rodents. In the late 1890s, Y. pestis arrived in San Francisco, probably carried there by stowaway rats on an Asian merchant ship, and causing a small epidemic among Chinese immigrants. Almost immediately, ground squirrels picked up the microbe, and it now circulates in the U.S., where there are over 50 rodent species to act as potential carriers. This huge plague focus stretches from Canada to Mexico and halfway across the U.S., so the microbe is poised to jump to humans whenever the opportunity arises. The plague foci in the Himalayas, Eurasia, and Central Africa are considered ancient, and most experts agree that the first pandemic, the Justinian Plague of AD 542, see Chapter 4, arose from the plague focus in Central Africa. But the origin of the Black Death is not so clear-cut. Some think it came from the focus in Africa, but most believe that it emerged from the Himalayan plague focus, perhaps aided by the invading Mongols, who were in the habit of killing, possibly microbe-carrying, marmots for their fur. Remarkably, recent genetic studies show that Y. pestis only diverged from its closest relative, Y. pseudotuberculosis, sometime between 1,500 and 20,000 years ago, so it is a relatively new pathogen to both rodents and humans. And since Y. pseudotuberculosis is a gut microbe that infects many mammal species, including rats, and spreads in food and water, it must have undergone several major genetic changes to evolve into the virulent, flea-borne Y. pestis we know today. Y. pseudotuberculosis sometimes circulates in the blood of rodents, so from there it could have been picked up by biting fleas, that this would be a dead-end infection until the microbe could not only survive in and colonize the flea's gut, but also multiply and spread from the bite site in the flea's next victim. Most experts agree that even 20,000 years is way too short a period for all these changes to evolve by random mutation, so the microbe must have picked up plasmids from other bacteria that completely revolutionized its life cycle. Human plague pandemics begin with Y. pestis escaping from its reservoir to infect other wild rodents, and this is usually precipitated by favorable climatic conditions and an abundant food supply, resulting in overpopulation. This drives the inhabitants of the plague focus to forage over a larger area where they are more likely to make contact with and share fleas with other species. Some of these species are highly susceptible to Y. pestis. Rats, in particular, die within days of infection, and it is these animals that form the critical link to human epidemics. In most of Europe today, the brown sewer rat, Rattus norvegicus, a hardy creature whose origins are in Russia, is the commonest type, but since it only arrived in Britain some time after the last plague outbreak, it could not have been responsible for spreading the microbe at the time of the Black Death. This dubious accolade goes to the black rat, Rattus rattus, or house rat, which, unlike the brown rat, is not all that hardy. Its ancestral home is in India, in the foothills of the Himalayas, but long ago it spread throughout the tropics. Black rats were well established in North Africa by the beginning of the Christian era. Then, as international trade routes opened up, the rats followed along. They stowed away on ships, crossed the Mediterranean, and colonized ports along all the main shipping routes. Then they spread throughout Europe, accompanying caravans of traders on their journeys from town to town, reaching Britain sometime in the Middle Ages. They found a niche in colder regions by cohabiting with humans, making nests in the thatched roofs of houses, in granaries and barns, and being territorial animals, each rural household generally supported one distinct colony. But in towns and cities, black rat colonies knew no boundaries. The crowded, squalid dwellings were simply overrun with them. So by medieval times, the black rat was well placed to act as an intermediary host for Y. pestis, and their fleas, each rat has an average of three, as the vehicle that carried it to man. Once Y. pestis gets a foothold in a black rat colony and is passed between the residents by their fleas, rats die rapidly. Fleas carrying Y. pestis desert the dying for the living, so after 10 to 14 days, the microbe has virtually wiped out the whole colony. By then, the place is literally swarming with desperately hungry fleas, and although human blood is very much second best for rat fleas, at this stage they are ready to try anything, and one bite is enough to deliver a potentially lethal injection to humans. There are 2,500 different types of flea, and not all can transmit Y. pestis, but the rat flea, Xenopsylla chiopis, seems especially designed for the task. Its stomach has an entry valve that allows it to become fully distended with blood without regurgitating the contents the next time the insect feeds. But after a blood meal containing Y. pestis, the bacteria multiply to form a ball of microbes mixed with blood in the flea's stomach that inactivates the valve. So the next time the flea tries to feed, it regurgitates its stomach contents, now containing up to 25,000 bacteria, into its new victim. And not content with that, the frustrated flea, still hungry, goes on desperately biting and spreading the bacteria until it literally starves to death. So plague victims are not directly infectious to others, and fleas cannot transmit the disease between them because in human blood, Y. pestis does not reach the high concentrations required to block a flea's stomach. But rat fleas, unlike the human variety, actually cling on to their host and travel with them. So if a visitor to a plague victim's home unwittingly picks up a Y. pestis-carrying rat flea, it will hitch a ride to their home, not only infecting the carrier, but also their local rat population, setting the whole cycle in motion and producing a new crop of human disease some 24 days later. Fleas can also survive for some time without their rat or human hosts, particularly in cool, moist conditions. So Y. pestis can remain alive on long sea voyages, even if it has killed the resident rat population before the ship arrives in port. Fleas usually bite exposed areas of skin, like the face, arm, or leg, and once injected, Y. pestis travels to and multiplies in the local lymph glands in the neck, armpit, or groin, respectively. And although the immune system is alerted, this microbe has a veritable armament of devices ready to foil the attack. It grows happily inside macrophages when they engulf and try to kill it, and it tricks the body into overproducing suppressive cytokines that knock out key immune cells. This strategy gains time, and the microbe can multiply to enormous numbers, causing the glands to swell into the characteristic buboes, huge, exquisitely painful abscesses. If the immune attack succeeds in restricting the microbe to the gland, then the victim stands a chance of surviving, particularly if the buboes rupture and discharge their stinking pus. But all too often, Y. pestis is one step ahead, spilling out into the bloodstream, attacking blood vessels, and causing bleeding into vital organs. Skin hemorrhages produce the typical dark spots, called God's tokens, because they almost invariably herald the victim's death. This gruesome picture describes classic bubonic plague, lasting 4 to 5 days, but during epidemics, many people died just hours after its onset. This can happen if a flea injects bacteria straight into a small blood vessel, when the disease progresses so rapidly that the victim is dead before the buboes develop. In other cases, Y. pestis escapes from the buboes and settles in the lungs, causing pneumonia. Then, sufferers cough up bloody sputum, heaving with bacteria, so switching the transmission route to airborne droplets. Anyone inhaling these droplets develops primary pneumonic plague, which is rapidly and universally fatal. So, unlike classic bubonic plague, pneumonic plague spreads directly from person to person. In most epidemics, up to a quarter of cases are pneumonic, but there have been entire epidemics of pneumonic plague, the most recent in Manchuria in 1910 and 1920. Yet although the mortality is devastatingly high, the droplets generated are heavy, so the microbe can only spread a few meters from the sufferer, and as the disease is so rapidly fatal, these epidemics generally remain localized and are relatively easy to control. Most scholars agree that the Black Death, as well as the following plague cycles that lasted for 300 years, ending with the Great Plague of London, were epidemics of classic bubonic plague caused by Y. pestis. But since the bacterium was not identified until 600 years after the Black Death, this is mainly speculation based on eyewitness accounts, particularly of the characteristic buboes. Recently, a few scientists and historians have questioned this assumption, making the point that buboes are not unique to the plague, and that at the time of the Black Death, people were in no doubt that sufferers were highly infectious. There are many first-hand reports attesting to this. The following is from Guy de Chauliac, physician to Pope Clement VI, written as the Black Death hit Avignon in 1348. It was so contagious, especially that accompanied by spitting of blood, that not only by staying together, but even by looking at one another, people caught it, with the result that men died without attendants and were buried without priests. The father did not visit his son, nor the son the father. Charity was dead and hope crushed. This description could, of course, refer to the pneumonic form of the disease, as the spitting of blood tends to suggest. But the quarantine and isolation measures put in place to prevent direct person-to-person spread would have had no restraining effect on rats and their fleas, yet on occasions they did seem to restrict the epidemic. Add to this the fact that even the most detailed eyewitness accounts fail to mention a single dead rat, and we certainly have a basis for closer investigation. The now famous events in the village of Ime in Derbyshire, England, which was struck by plague in September 1665, serve to illustrate the widely held belief in isolation measures. According to popular legend, Y. Pestis arrived in the village in a box of cloth, presumably containing an infected flea, delivered from London, where plague was raging. Itinerant tailor George Vickers, who opened the box, rapidly fell ill and died of the plague. Starting with this single case, an epidemic spread throughout the village, and although it virtually disappeared in the winter, it reappeared in the spring of 1666 with increased ferocity. By this stage, all those with the means to do so had deserted the village, and Reverend William Montpesson, rector of the village church, persuaded those remaining to isolate the village, in the hope that if no one entered or left, the epidemic would be contained, saving the surrounding population. So from May to December 1666, the villagers were entirely cut off from the outside world, the only points of contact being boundary stones above the village where their grateful neighbours left food and medical supplies. The people could only wait and watch as the plague decimated families, created orphans, and divided lovers. The epidemic reached its peak in August and was over by December. In the course of the year, it wiped out 259 of the 350 villages. No plague was reported that year in nearby villages, so although isolation did not prevent the microbe from its relentless spread through Ime, it was apparently successful in avoiding spread further afield. Those who doubt that this epidemic was caused by Y. pestis argue that isolation would not have prevented rats from carrying the microbe to other villages, but since Ime was in a remote spot, it was perhaps more likely to have spread to the surrounding villages by infected fleas carried on humans or in goods, just as it is supposed to have arrived in the village. Montpesson, who lost his wife Catherine in the epidemic, kept meticulous records of the destructive course of the microbe, and today's history trail through the village is a poignant reminder of its sad past. An accurate household-by-household reconstruction of the whole episode suggests to some that the microbe spread directly between people with an incubation period of around 32 days, and that victims were infectious for the last 18 days. Then followed the illness, lasting 5 to 7 days and ending in death or recovery. If this scenario is correct, then the disease the villagers suffered was certainly not the plague. Other arguments that convince some experts that whatever caused the ravages of the Black Death and subsequent outbreaks was not Y. pestis relate to the black rat and its resident fleas. Since there were no plague foci in Europe in the Middle Ages, and still are not, the microbe had to be imported at the start of the pandemic and then maintained in a resident rodent population. And since brown rats only colonized Europe in the 18th century, black rats were the only rodent capable of carrying the microbe. However, they argue that because black rats require warmth, they would have been uncommon anywhere beyond southern Europe. So although they arrived in northern European ports as part of a ship's cargo, the cold winters of the Little Ice Age stopped them from spreading far inland. But others argued that the Black Death clearly spread throughout Europe along trade routes, the very paths used by black rats as they followed shipments of grain inland from the coast. Also, black rat skeletons have been found in the sites of Roman encampments in Britain, including York in the north. But of course, this does not prove that they were widespread. Perhaps a more convincing argument against the Black Death being caused by Y. pestis is that rat fleas require a minimum temperature of 18 degrees centigrade for their breeding cycles. So some say that in medieval northern Europe, fleas would only be active in the summer months and could not have transmitted the microbe in winter. Taking this into account, they argued that the disease could not possibly have engulfed the whole of Europe in just 3 years if flea-borne Y. pestis was responsible. The rat-flea argument is most convincing in relation to Iceland, which is said to have been rat-free at the time. Nevertheless, devastating episodes of plague occurred in Iceland in 1402 and 1494, carried there by ship from Britain and spreading over the whole island, not even halted by the cold Arctic winters. One final argument cites the death rate during the pandemic as being too high for genuine plague. Most experts agree that the Black Death killed 30 to 40% of the population, and in some outbreaks the death rate was as high as 60 to 70%. This, they say, is higher than that recorded in more recent epidemics, where at most 2% of the population died, and far too high for classical plague. However, in a genuine plague outbreak, the death rate will vary according to the number of cases of the invariably fatal pneumonic form spread from person to person. These pieces of evidence seem to cast reasonable doubt on the Black Death being caused by Y. pestis, and clearly this controversy will rage on until some definitive proof comes to light. This is likely to be from molecular analysis of human remains, in theory just the kind of all-or-nothing test that is needed to clear up the mystery. Already, a group of French scientists claim to have found Y. pestis DNA in the dental pulp of teeth from skeletons thought to be from the Black Death in Montpellier in the south of France. However, others working on teeth taken from mass graves in northern Europe, including plague pits at Smithfield and Spitalfields in London, failed to find any evidence of Y. pestis infection. They disregard the French finding, suggesting that it merely represents contamination of the samples. Clearly, we will have to wait a little longer to find out the truth, but in the meantime, if Y. pestis did not cause the Black Death, then what was it that caused such devastation? Experts who deny that the Black Death was caused by Y. pestis suggest that the pandemic could have been caused by an ancestor of this microbe that behaved very differently from the one we know today, or possibly by anthrax, but they tend to favour an as-yet unidentified hemorrhagic fever virus resembling the Ebola virus. They speculate that this Ebola-like virus could have been an ancient zoonotic infection of early humans acquired from other primate species in Africa. They further suggest that it caused the plague of Athens, the Justinian plague, and other epidemics around this time, then found a niche in early Middle Eastern civilizations before bursting out to cause the Black Death. These claims may seem far-fetched, particularly with no concrete evidence to go on, but if true, Then why was this virus restricted to Europe for 300 years after the Black Death, at a time when true bubonic plague was raging in Asia and North Africa? Since there must have been many other microbes circulating during the 300 years of the plague pandemic, perhaps a mixture of epidemics could explain the discrepancies highlighted by those who are skeptical of Y. pestis being the sole culprit. Marseille, in southern France, saw the final outbreak of plague in Western Europe in 1720, and so the last unanswered question about the pandemic, whatever its microbiological nature, is why it disappeared after the Renaissance plague. There are many suggested reasons for the plague's demise, but none are particularly convincing on their own. Firstly, 300 years is quite long enough for genetic resistance to build up in a population, and there is some evidence that a gene now carried by around 1% of Europeans today, that inadvertently protects them from HIV infection, may have conferred resistance against the plague. However, Y. pestis itself shows no signs of reduced virulence. The 1720 epidemic in Marseille killed between a third and a half of the population, and when an outbreak struck San Francisco in 1907, 78 of the 160 victims died. This high virulence is probably because Y. pestis primarily lives in rodents, and is unlikely to adapt to humans as an occasional dead-end host. Indeed, the Indian Plague Research Commission found that only microbes that can grow rapidly and reach very high numbers in a flea's stomach cause the blockage necessary for transfer to humans, so this, in itself, would select for highly virulent strains. Temperature change, coincident with the beginning of the Little Ice Age around 1450, probably also had a deleterious effect, since the plague, whatever its nature, generally struggled to survive the winter in northern Europe. If this was because rats and their fleas need warmth, then the replacement of houses of wood and thatch with brick and tiles, which occurred around this time and was hastened in London by the Great Fire of 1666, must have deprived them of their warm nesting sites. And indeed, by the 18th century, the black rat had been mainly supplanted by the hardier brown rat. These changes, combined with the improved general health and nutrition of the population, are the best explanation that can be offered for the end of the ferocious killer in Europe. Worldwide, the Black Death killed an estimated 25 million, and in England alone, the death toll was some 1.4 million, around a third of the population. Obviously, such a loss in just 3 years had a profound effect on the survivors, and several reminders of the devastating event can still be found in our literature. The famous children's nursery rhyme, Ring a Ring of Roses, and Robert Browning's poem, The Pied Piper of Hamelin, are both said to have been inspired by the plague, while Giovanni Boccaccio's collection of 100 novellas in the Decameron, beginning with a graphic description of the plague, was written in 1348 as the epidemic raged in Florence. Whether or not the pandemic actually changed the course of history is still much debated. Of course, wherever the pandemic hit, chaos ensued, with the fear of infection itself becoming infectious. Even epidemics in modern times, such as HIV, unleash a sequence of terror and panic, denial, anger, and a search for scapegoats, the illogical apportioning of blame, low morale and apathy, before the eventual acceptance of the inevitable. And this is in the light of our knowledge of microbes and how to combat them. How much more frightening, then, an epidemic that strikes out of the blue for no apparent reason. The rich and healthy fled. The dead were left to rot. Thieves and cheats took their opportunities. Fields were unploughed and cattle untended. But on the whole, when the worst was over, survivors did what they could to carry on. Most historians agree that the Black Death, coming at a time of deprivation and famine, accentuated and accelerated the social and economic changes that heralded the modern era. Much has been written about the breakup of the feudal system, but whereas some maintain that the Black Death was the direct trigger for it, others believe that the changes were well in progress before the ravages of the Black Death. Whatever the truth of it, the surviving peasants certainly benefited. With the dramatic fall in population that did not recover for 300 years, they suddenly found themselves with more land and their services in high demand. At the same time, overproduction of food led to a fall in prices and a rise in living standards. But with the plague finally gone, other microbes rose to prominence, seeming to fill the niche that it had so recently vacated. In particular, the crowd diseases continued to take their toll, and most feared among them was smallpox. Smallpox. The deadly smallpox virus, variola major, which kills around a third of those it infects, was one of the earliest human zoonotic infections, but exactly how, when and where it transferred its allegiance to man is a controversial issue that will probably never be resolved. Some suggest that smallpox is the human form of monkeypox, acquired by our ancient ancestors in equatorial Africa, and others think that it evolved from cowpox at the time of domestication of cattle. But recent molecular analysis shows that V. major's closest relatives are the viruses that cause camel pox and gerbil pox, suggesting that all three arose quite recently from a common ancestor. Like the measles virus, the smallpox virus could only become a purely human pathogen once populations were large and dense enough to sustain it, and among the earliest civilizations likely to provide this niche are those based on irrigation farming in the Euphrates, Tigris, Nile, Ganges, and Indus river valleys. Camels and gerbils were both common in these regions, so perhaps an ancient pox virus of rodents jumped to humans and camels some 5,000 to 10,000 years ago. There is certainly some evidence of smallpox in these centres from early times. Sanskrit medical texts from India mention a disease which sounds like smallpox, indicating that it was probably known there from around 1500 BC, and descriptions in ancient Egyptian papyri written between 3730 and 1555 BC are also suggestive of smallpox. But the most persuasive evidence comes from three Egyptian mummies dating from 1570 to 1085 BC, which bear skin lesions reminiscent of smallpox. And in samples taken from the lesions of one of these, the mummy of King Ramses V, who died suddenly in 1157 BC, while still only in his early 30s, pox-like viruses have been spotted under the electron microscope. At this time, Europe was too sparsely populated to maintain smallpox permanently, so although epidemics may occasionally have spilled over from North Africa, it was not until the rise of the Greek Empire that the microbe could extend its territory in this direction. Indeed, the plague of Athens in 430 BC, chapter 3, could well have been its debut in Europe. And from then on, it circulated continuously, particularly in the most populous parts of France and Italy. However, in Britain, where the population remained thin and scattered, smallpox was probably just an occasional visitor, crossing the English Channel from continental Europe from time to time, until, arriving with the invading Normans in 1066 and the returning Crusaders of the 12th and 13th centuries, the virus finally managed to establish a permanent base. Bishop Gregory of Tours gave one of the earliest descriptions of smallpox during an epidemic that hit France and Italy in AD 580. Such was the nature of the infirmity that a person, after being seized with a violent fever, was covered all over with vesicles and small pustules. The vesicles were white, hard, and unyielding, and very painful. If the patient survived to their maturation, they broke and began to discharge when the pain was greatly increased by the adhesion to the clothes of the body. Among others, the lady of Count Eberin, while laboring under this pest, was so covered with the vesicles that neither her hands nor feet nor any part of the body remained exempt, for her eyes were wholly closed up by them. The smallpox virus spreads through the air, is inhaled by its victims, and once inside, it multiplies in lymph glands. Then it accesses the bloodstream and targets all the major organs. Here, it spends 2 weeks multiplying until, as thousands of viruses swarm into the blood, the first signs of the illness appear. Starting with sore throat, headache, fever, and general aches and pains, which might be caused by any number of microbes, it is not until 4 days later that the characteristic rash appears and the feared diagnosis is confirmed. The disease varies from deadly hemorrhagic smallpox, where bleeding causes the pox to turn black and coalesce, to the more common form, with the pox progressing through a series of changes as the body's immune system assaults these virus factories. Beginning as discrete red spots, the pox first fill with fluid, then turn from silver to yellow as pus accumulates. On the 8th day, the pox start to rupture, discharging their virus-laden contents and then drying into scabs. These are eventually shed, all too often leaving unsightly scars and sometimes causing blindness. During the long course of the illness, sufferers generally remain alert, but in excruciating pain, not only from the pox, but also from damaged internal organs and suppurating mouth and throat ulcers. The virus is shed in mucus droplets from these ulcers, but being relatively heavy, the droplets do not travel far and mainly threaten household contacts. Given the right conditions, the virus can survive for a long time in the environment, and since both pox fluid and scabs contain thousands of viruses, these can lurk in dust or be carried away in clothing or blankets. R0 for smallpox is 5 to 10, and on average, the virus spreads to around half of the non-immune contacts. This may sound bad enough, but compared with measles, with an R0 value of 15 and spread to 90% of contacts, smallpox is the less successful spreader. Although both viruses probably first jumped to humans in the early farming era, the smallpox virus is much less well adapted to humans and still highly virulent. This striking difference is explained by their genetic makeup. Whereas measles has an RNA genome with an inherently high mutation rate, the smallpox virus is a stable DNA virus that will take much longer to adapt to humans. Interestingly, a mutant virus, V. minor, which appeared in South America in the early 1900s, caused a milder form of smallpox with a fatality rate of around 1%. This may have been a human-adapted strain, which, given time, might have replaced more virulent strains, but since the virus has now been eliminated from the wild, we will never know. As the smallpox virus is not a highly efficient spreader, and in addition, there is no silent shedding during the incubation period, and no human or animal can harbor a secret store of virus, you begin to wonder how it ever created such havoc around the world, killing at its peak around 400,000 Europeans every year, and an estimated 300 million worldwide in the 20th century alone. But the virus could not have obtained such a stranglehold if it had not been aided and abetted by humans, and again, it was our lifestyle that was instrumental in assisting its spread. Smallpox is a classic crowd disease that reached its peak as urbanization, followed by industrialization in the late 18th century, accentuated the differential between urban rich and poor. Charles Dickens, writing in the 19th century, eloquently documented the plight of the poor in London, where whole families often shared a single room in cold, damp, infested tenements with no ventilation or means of waste disposal. And with no organized support for the needy, the filthy streets thronged with the homeless and destitute. As with almost any infectious disease at the time, the only known preventive measures for smallpox, isolation of cases and fleeing the area, were open solely to the rich, so the poor were left to bear the brunt of an epidemic. In spite of this, the smallpox virus was so ubiquitous that the rich and famous could not escape entirely, and a glance at the family trees of European royalty is enough to convince you that smallpox changed the course of history on many occasions by picking off reigning monarchs and their heirs. In England, Elizabeth I had been queen for only 4 years and was enjoying herself at Hampton Court Palace when the microbe struck. She sent her doctor packing when he mentioned the possibility of smallpox, but he had to be hastily recalled when later, the same day, she developed the characteristic rash and sank into a coma. With no heir, Europe in turmoil, and Mary Queen of Scots recently returned from France and now on her very doorstep, this was not a convenient time for the Queen to die. Fortunately, she recovered with her beauty unscathed to reign over England for another 41 years. But others were not so lucky. As the centuries passed, the grip of the virus got steadily tighter. With the plague virtually gone from Europe by the end of the 17th century, and with leprosy on the decline, smallpox became the most common killer, accounting for over 5% of all deaths in London. Again, the royal family did not escape. Indeed, when Charles II was recalled from France in 1660, 11 years after his father's execution, everything looked well for the Stuarts. But within a generation, they were gone, wiped out by the deadly virus. Charles II lost his brother Henry and sister Mary to the virus, and with no legitimate offspring of his own, he was succeeded by his brother James II. James had no living sons, one having died of smallpox, so when his unpopular Catholic faith caused him to relinquish the throne 3 years later, it passed to his daughter Mary II and her husband and cousin, William of Orange. Shortly after their succession, the still childless Mary died of smallpox, so William, who survived smallpox as a child but lost both his parents to the disease, ruled alone for 8 years. He was succeeded by Mary's sister Anne, whose only son died of smallpox, so her death heralded the end of the Stuart line. And the British monarchy was not the only one in Europe to suffer from the smallpox virus. Within 80 years of the demise of the Stuarts, Emperor Joseph I of Austria, King Louis I of Spain, King Louis XV of France, Queen Ulrika Eleonora of Sweden, and Tsar Peter II of Russia all died of the disease. Smallpox epidemics increased in frequency and ferocity right through to the 19th century, when the pattern was finally broken, first by the advent of inoculation and then vaccination, see Chapter 8. But before that, the virus, along with hundreds of other microbes, went global, beginning its cycle of killing in the totally naive population it encountered in the New World. 5. Microbes go global. As the sea level rose at the end of the last ice age, the Bering Strait land bridge, linking Siberia and Alaska, submerged and America became an island. the descendants of the Mongoloid people who crossed the bridge some 14,000 years ago were isolated, cut off from the inhabitants of the Old World and their microbes. In previous chapters, we have followed the evolution of infectious disease microbes in the Old World. Now, we cross the Atlantic to catch up with the Native American people in the New World. By the time contact between the Old and New Worlds was re-established in the late 15th century, there were around 100 million Native Americans, some living in scattered communities, but with two great flourishing civilizations, the Incas in Peru and the Aztecs in central Mexico, each containing some 20